We've just finished a study of the book of Jeremiah and what God was doing, not just in that book, but in history that that book records. God found it necessary to punish His people, the Jewish people, because they had broken covenant with Him. And as we went through that book, there were many different things we learned and saw in that. But I sort of left one little thing hanging that I want to cover with you this morning. Because we saw in that Jeremiah study that God was not only bringing down upon Judah judgment because of its failures and its sins, but that God would also judge the nations around. That the very people He was using to punish Judah, He would then turn and punish. And I thought it would be appropriate as we live through times of doubt and uncertainty, turmoil, and even terrorism and war in our world, that we need to be reminded once again who really is in charge. That should be a constant theme, I think, among God's people. Often we feel powerless at the things that are going on around us. And we even live in a nation where we have some say in our government. Imagine how believers in other parts of the world must feel. We sometimes question the ability of our leaders to lead correctly. We question what other nations are going to do or live in fear of them. Economic times, political times, other kinds of things that are going on seem to be beyond our ability to control. My heart really went out this past week as I tried to follow somewhat the things that were happening in the nation of Ecuador. You know, we have a large number of brothers and sisters who live in that nation. I have friends who are down there working in the churches and teaching in the schools that are there, sharing the gospel with the lost and helping the brothers and sisters there who speak the Spanish language grow in their faith. And when suddenly the nation looked like it was on the verge of collapse. The president was injured and was in the hospital getting some treatment for that, and the hospital was assaulted by the police force. It looked like the nation was about to go into tyranny. And they're in a democratic nation like we are. Their president is elected by vote, but it looked like he was about to be removed by force. And I had to wonder what the Christians in that nation, especially in Quito, the capital city where this was all happening, were thinking. They had to be not only hunkered down, so to speak, in their homes and trying to follow as best they could on the news media what was happening in their nation, but I had to believe that many of them were also down on their knees praying that God's will be done through whatever was going on in their nation, because certainly they were powerless to do anything about it themselves. And oftentimes we ask ourselves, and no doubt they were, and some of them, saying, is God really in control? Because often God does not do what we would do, and what we think He should do, and what we even ask Him to do when it comes to matters like this. We like to say that we walk by faith and not by sight, but sometimes that's very hard to do. The Scriptures are given, it tells us in Romans chapter 15, in verse 4, among other places, the things that were written before our time were written for our learning, that we through patience and the comfort, and some translations say the encouragement of the Scriptures, might have hope. That tells us that we need to have patience or endurance. We don't judge what's going on in the world by just an instant or a moment. Almost all of us are old enough to remember when President Kennedy was assassinated. And even though I was just in high school at that time, I was already a Christian and a believer. And I know not only in that school I was in that day, but in my family and in the church and in our community, there was great doubt about what the future held because of that. We as Christians must have patience. We don't judge what's happening in the world by what happens in a moment or in a day. The same is true with the events of 9/11, 2001. We watched in horror as we were getting ready for work that morning, and we watched the morning news. I think that broke us of the habit, actually. After that, we stopped. But every morning we'd have on the CNN headline news or something as we were getting ready for work, and suddenly to start getting the reports and then seeing the video of the planes crashing into the Twin Towers, and then getting word of other planes crashing in Washington, D.C. and in Pennsylvania, and reports of more in the air and potentially being, you know, living bombs to attack other parts of our nation. But we don't live in that moment in terms of our faith. We don't base what our faith is in what happens in those moments. We base our faith upon eternal things. And because the scriptures were written for our encouragement and our comfort as we look back at them, I just want to remind us again at the beginning here of the fact that in the scriptures, the uniform presentation of the scriptures is that God reigns in the affairs of men. Now we have the blessing as we read the scriptures of divine revelation as we read this. As we look at modern affairs, we don't have that blessing. God is not presently revealing himself in all the specifics of what he's doing in our world today. But he has revealed what he's done in the past in order to give us comfort about the present. And as I think back through the Old Testament, I think of the days of Joseph. When a young man, the next to the youngest son of a man to whom God had promised that his descendants would always be blessed by God, that this man Jacob had these numerous sons. And next to the youngest one ends up being taken by his older brothers and sold into slavery because of jealousy and envy. And he ends up going down to Egypt as a slave there. And he is first of all a slave in the home of a prominent Egyptian official. He's there for quite some time. And then he's falsely charged by that man's wife with something inappropriate, which he did not do. She was the one who was inappropriate. But then she charged him with being inappropriate, and he's thrown into prison. But through a series of circumstances that only God could have managed, he actually is in prison with two men who are at the right hand of, normally would be at the right hand of the king of Egypt, the Pharaoh. And because of the help he provides for them, and the fact that they become convinced that God is with him, he has the opportunity actually to rise up and be of service to the Pharaoh, and before it's all over with, becomes Pharaoh's second in command of the entire nation of Egypt. That's how God rules in the affairs of men. Then God uses him in that position to save his own family in a time of great drought and desperation and need. That family grows and multiplies over several hundred years in Egypt, and then it's time for them to come out. But the Pharaoh who now reigns knows nothing of Joseph 400 years ago. And he only sees all these people who are here, these Hebrews, as part of the great economic boon that Egypt was in. And they provide the back power and the manpower to make that all possible. And when someone named Moses shows up and says, it's time for these people to go home and God wants to lead them out, he says no. In fact, it says in the book of Exodus between chapter 7 and 9, at least seven different times it says that Pharaoh hardened his heart. Because see, Pharaoh believed he was in charge. And yet God had sent Moses and in effect was saying, no, I rule in the affairs of men. Eventually, Pharaoh is told and is repeated over in the book of Romans, chapter 9. Paul repeats it over there, Romans chapter 9 and verse 17, for the scripture says to Pharaoh, I raised you up for this very purpose, that I might display my power in you, and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth. Pharaoh thought he ruled Egypt. It was time for God to explain to him that God ruled Pharaoh. And that God was going to use Pharaoh, whether a hardened heart or a soft heart, to display God's power and God's glory. And so it ultimately says in the book of Exodus and in chapter 14, Exodus 14 and verse 17, God speaks to Moses and says, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them. This is by the time the people have actually left and they're down to the sea, and it looks like they're caught in a tight spot because the Egyptians are coming and they can't cross the sea. And God is about to open up that sea to demonstrate His power. But He speaks to Moses and all that and says, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them, and I will gain glory through Pharaoh and all his army, through his chariots and his horsemen. The Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I gain glory through Pharaoh. And certainly that's what happened. Then the angel of the Lord went in front of them, and suddenly the sea opened up, and the people of God are able to go through. The Egyptians chased them in, and as the Israelites reach dry ground on the other side, God starts closing the sea back up over the top of the Egyptians. And Pharaoh, to his horror, watches on the far shore as he sees his great army destroyed by the power of God. Now, unfortunately, it took 11 demonstrations of God's power before Pharaoh was finally broken and acknowledged that God was God, even over Egypt and over Pharaoh. As time goes on, we have many other examples in the Old Testament of that, but just some that really stood out in my mind is the book of Jonah. The book of Jonah is a story of a time in early in the history of this nation of Assyria, when Nineveh had reached a point. Ancient Assyria was known as the most wicked of the empires that existed in that part of the world in their time. They were the people, as we talked about in Bible class this morning, that led their captives away with hooks in their noses and nooses around their neck. They were the ones who showed such disregard for human life that they would take the kings that they had captured and skin them alive, and then stretch their skins up on the walls of their palaces as trophies. A cruel, murderous, mean people. And God calls one of his prophets by the name of Jonah and says, Jonah, I want you to go to Nineveh and preach to this people that I'm about to destroy them for their sins. Jonah didn't want to go. A lot of question about why Jonah didn't want to go. I think the simple answer is pretty obvious. So he didn't want there to be any possibility that God might change his mind and not destroy them. And so we have the story of Jonah and the great fish, as Jonah's going one direction and God is turning him around to send him back the right direction. And finally, when he does go to Nineveh, he goes into that great city. And it says it was so large it took 3 days to cross from one side to the other of it walking. And that's a large city. And he's preaching that God is about to destroy their city because of their sin. And the word comes to the king and many of the people, and they start repenting. And they go into mourning. They put on sackcloth and put ashes on their heads, which was a sign of mourning and penitence and seeking that God would not destroy them for their sins. And God changed his mind. And then Jonah's mad, isn't he? And God says, why are you mad? I've just decided not to destroy people I love. Well, number one, Jonah didn't want God to love them. Number two, Jonah didn't want God to save them. And he says, I have a right to be angry because I knew that if I came and preached to them and they repented, I knew you wouldn't destroy them. But what does that story really tell us? In the big picture, it says God still was intervening in the affairs of men, and God was at work. The time will come when God will allow Assyria to be destroyed by another nation called Babylon. And he will raise up a man to rule over the Babylonians by the name of Nebuchadnezzar. We read about him not only in the book of Jeremiah, but also in the book of Daniel. And while Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians were not nearly as cruel and vicious as the Assyrians that they had replaced, they nevertheless were a idol-worshipping, wicked people. And their set of standards of right and wrong was very different than what God's was. And while God said that he was using these people as his instruments to punish the Jewish people, God's people, God also said, afterwards then, I will punish them for their sins. But while Nebuchadnezzar reigned, we have some interesting stories in the book of Daniel concerning Nebuchadnezzar. We hear God say concerning Nebuchadnezzar that he was God's servant. God was using him. He was serving God to accomplish his purposes. In another place, it actually says that he was a tool, an instrument of God. Now, that doesn't mean Nebuchadnezzar saw himself that way, but that is what the reality was. And Nebuchadnezzar has a dream in Daniel chapter 4. And in this dream, he has a dream in which he sees a tree, a mighty tree. And suddenly he sees someone come and cut that tree down and trim away all of its branches and put an iron band around the stump that's left behind. And that greatly disturbs him because he doesn't understand what that dream means. And by that time, he had learned to trust a Jewish man that was in his government by the name of Daniel. And so he calls in Daniel to explain to him what that dream meant. And so Daniel tells him in Daniel 4, verse 24, "This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has been issued against my lord the king. You will be driven away from people and will live with the wild animals. You will eat grass like cattle and be drenched with the dew of heaven. 7 times or 7 years will pass by for you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and gives them to anyone he wishes. The command to leave the stump of the tree with its roots means that your kingdom will be restored to you when you acknowledge that heaven rules. Therefore, O king, be pleased to accept my advice. Renounce your sins by doing what is right and your wickedness by being kind to the oppressed. It may be that then your prosperity will continue." Daniel, with a different attitude, is really saying the same thing that Jonah had said to Nineveh, isn't he? "If you repent, perhaps God will relent." 12 months later, as the king was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, he said, "Is not this the great Babylon I have built as a royal residence by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty?" The words were still on his lips when a voice came from heaven. "This is what I decreed for you, King Nebuchadnezzar. Your royal authority has been taken from you. You will be driven away from people and will live with the wild animals. You will eat grass like cattle. 7 years will pass by for you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and gives them to anyone he wishes." Immediately, what had been said about Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled. He was driven away from people and ate grass like cattle. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair grew like the feathers of an eagle and his nails like the claws of a bird. But at the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven and my sanity was restored. Then I praised the Most High. I honored and glorified him who lives forever. For his dominion is an eternal dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the peoples of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as he pleases with the powers of heaven and the peoples of the earth. No one can hold back his hand or say to him, "What have you done?" God reigned in the affairs of men. Eventually, Nebuchadnezzar died and went to the same place that his fathers had gone, and he was replaced by his son and then by his grandson. And his grandson's name was Belshazzar. And Belshazzar fought no wars. He lived in a time of peace and prosperity. He had just enjoyed the fruits of what his grandfather and his father had done before him. And while his grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar, had been very careful when he had even conquered the Jews and destroyed their city and destroyed their temple, he had taken every single vessel out of that temple and recognized that they were holy. And he had taken them very carefully and cataloged them and had them transported to Babylon and stored away in storehouses and hadn't desecrated them, had not used them or anything like that. But his son, his grandson, rises up and he doesn't know about God. He only knows the idols he worships. And so he has this bright idea as now the ruler of all the Babylonians that he'll throw a great party for all of his authorities, all of his governors, all of those who reigned underneath him. And because he was convinced that his deity, his God, his idol, had made all this possible, that he would even take out of that storehouse where his grandfather had stored them, all those vessels that belonged to God. And he would use them as the serving vessels for this great banquet he was going to have for them. And that story is found in the very next chapter of Daniel, Daniel chapter 5. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, our grandfather, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Suddenly the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale, and he was so frightened that his knees knocked together and his legs gave way. And the king called out for his wise men, his enchanters, his astrologers, and his interpreters of dreams to come and tell him what this all meant. Because right here in the middle of this great banquet he had on the wall right next to him, suddenly there was emblazoned in very large letters words that he did not know the meaning of. Now, they were in the Chaldean language, so he knew the words, but he didn't know what the interpretation, the meaning of them was. And nobody could tell him what they meant. But someone remembered that there was now a very old man who still sort of hung around the palace every once in a while and served in probably some fairly minor role in the government of Babylon by the name of Daniel, who had served in the days of his grandfather. And so they bring Daniel in to explain. And it says in verse 18, O king, the Most High God gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. And because of the high position he gave him, all the peoples and nations and men of every language dreaded and feared him. In verse 22, But you, his son, O Belshazzar, have not humbled yourself, though you know all this. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You had the goblets from his temple brought to you, and you and your nobles, your wives, and your concubines drank wine from them. You praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand, but you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. Therefore, he sent the hand that wrote the inscription. And this is the inscription that was written, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Parson. And this is what these words mean. Many. God has numbered the days of your reign and has brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. Perez, or Parson, your kingdom is divided and now given to the Medes and the Persians. Then at Belshazzar's command, Daniel was clothed in purple, a gold chain was placed around his neck, and he was proclaimed the third highest ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. That very night, it doesn't tell us here in Daniel, but history tells us that at the time this party and everything else is going on, Babylon was actually surrounded by the armies of the Medes and the Persians. But Belshazzar considered the city impregnable. It was such a great city and huge walls surrounded it. It's almost unimaginable how big and thick and high the walls were. And they had huge storehouses built inside from the days of Nebuchadnezzar, in which they had enough food stored, it's thought, to last 20 years, so they could outlast any attempt by an enemy to conquer them just simply by closing them up in their city and having a siege against them. They didn't have to worry about water because the great river Euphrates ran right through the middle of the city, under the wall and through the city and out the other end. So what did they have to worry about? They would just outwait their enemies. But that night, the Medes and the Persians had figured out a way upstream to divert the river. And suddenly the water stopped flowing. And the Medes and the Persians rushed into the city under the wall, in the riverbed, where the river had once flowed. And later that night, they found Belshazzar still sitting on his throne. and he was driven through by a sword, and his body, now dead, was pinned to the throne that he had never acknowledged until this moment actually belonged to God. God rules in the affairs of men. How many more stories could we tell of that? Even in the New Testament, the same is true. At the birth of Jesus, suddenly the ruler of the Roman Empire, the Caesar, the emperor, decides it's time for me to have everybody counted again so I can update my tax rolls. And a young man and his new bride, who was very pregnant with a child that God had caused to be formed inside of her, has to go back to his hometown of Bethlehem to be counted. And while there, the child is born. That all happened simply because God was in charge. As that same son stands 33 years later before Pontius Pilate, the governor that had been appointed by the Romans to rule over the Jews, Pilate basically asked Jesus, "Don't you know who I am?" And Jesus says, "You wouldn't have any authority unless you had received it from higher up." Now that was sort of a double intent on the part of Jesus. Certainly it was true that Pilate had been appointed by the emperor to be governor. But I think Jesus was pointing higher than that, because it struck great fear in Pontius Pilate at that time, because his wife had already been telling him, "There's something about this man. You need to be very careful with him." Later, God will end up having to destroy the Jewish people again because of their sins and destroy their city and their nation, because God reigns in the affairs of men. God rules the nations. He foretells their rise and fall long before they occur. He says that those who rule the nations are his tools and his servants in God's hand. He holds them accountable for their evil, their cruelty, their injustice, and their mistreatment of God's people. He tells us in places like Romans chapter 12 that they've actually been ordained by God to punish evil and uphold good. But something changed when the New Testament began. This Son of God that was born in Bethlehem and grew up to stand before Pontius Pilate, was crucified on a cross, rose from the dead 3 days later. Just before he ascended back to heaven, came to his disciples in Matthew chapter 28 and verse 18 and told them, "All authority has now been given to me in heaven and on earth." Jesus then ascended back to heaven, and according to Acts chapter 2, he then sat down on the throne of David at the right hand of the throne of God, and he began to rule as king over all kings and lord over all lords of the earth. And he reigns today. We may not know what the future holds, as people often say, but we know the one who holds the future. Jesus still sits on the throne. He still reigns over the affairs of men. And while we have the privilege in our nation of voting and participating in the political process to help change things we don't like, ultimately there's two other things we can do that will have a far greater effect on the future of our nation or of our world. Number one, pray. Pray. Pray because God says he hears the cries of his people when they're oppressed. Pray because God says he allows himself to be influenced by the requests of those who love him. So pray. Pray for our nation. Pray for other nations. Pray for things as they are, and pray for things as we wish they were. And number two, share the gospel. Because that's one thing that will have a far greater effect on the history of our world than going and voting. While I think we should vote, sharing the gospel with others will have a far greater effect. God rules in the affairs of men. That handwriting on the wall that Belshazzar saw was only a demonstration that God was in charge, and he would hold the nations accountable, and he would do what was right. We walk by faith and not by what we always see. We can believe that. We can trust that. And we can live out of that faith. We have an invitation song. It invites us to not just think about this, but our entire life and how we stand before God. Do we live like he rules in our life? Or do we have our lives filled with fear and doubt and questions and concerns that overwhelm our faith? Let's not do that. Let's be the people of God who even in most desperate times would still pray to God for his overreigning will to be done. And let's continue to share the good news that God can change hearts And when hearts change, people change. And when enough people change, nations change. And when nations change, the world changes. We can help you in any way in your walk with God. Come and let us know now while they stand up and sing this song.